Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
This episode of Beg to Differ is brought to you by BetterHelp. Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I am joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Wall Street Journal and the Brookings Institution, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is Robert Trzynski, who writes the Substack newsletter, The Trzynski Letter. Thanks, one and all. We are in the midst of it now. My old and dear friend, Jay Nordlinger, observed earlier within the past week that if you had said to a what we like to call the anti-anti-Trumpers, which includes, you know, the people at the Wall Street Journal editorial page and lots of others. If you had said to them a few weeks ago that a second Trump term would feature the likes of Matt Gaetz, which we'll get to in a second, Tulsi Gabbard, Pete Hegseth, Robert Kennedy Jr., they would have said, there you go. You are the victim of Trump derangement syndrome. You are letting your imagination run wild. There is, you know, that's ridiculous. And here we are. And it is, I guess we have to struggle to find humor, and we do in certain aspects of this, but it is as serious as a heart attack. Just before we came on air, we learned that one of the worst of these, although they're all really horrible, one of the worst, Matt Gaetz, has actually withdrawn his nomination. So Matt Gaetz, famous for his, not just his personal behavior problems, where he is, has been under investigation by the very Justice Department that he was tapped to head, and has been guilty of showing off nude photos of his girlfriends to other members on the floor of Congress, who has endorsed the great replacement theory that Jews are trying to bring dark-skinned immigrants into the country to replace the white majority. Who invited a Holocaust denier to the State of the Union, who appeared in a gas mask on the floor of Congress during the early days of the pandemic to mock any effort to control the spread, and particularly the efforts that Nancy Pelosi was making to enforce mask requirements and other measures within Congress itself. That guy, who promised Trump that he would go to the Justice Department and cut heads, that's a direct quote from our Mark Caputo, the Bulwark's Mark Caputo reporting. He was ultimately undone, not by any of that. Not by any of that. Those were all the qualifications. He was undone by the accusations that were about to we're dribbling out from the House Ethics Committee, although the Ethics Committee dug in its heels, that he had paid for sex with lots of women and included perhaps committed statutory rape with a 17-year-old. Okay, so Robert Trzynski, your reaction, first of all, to the Matt Gaetz withdrawal, and I'd love for you to just elaborate on, you had a great piece. Maybe we shouldn't start there, but it was so good about just sort of putting in context all of these horrifying and just garbage nominees and what that says about what Trump is trying to do to the government.
Right. So the thing that struck me about it is every one of these nominees is chosen almost as a deliberate negation of the thing he's supposed to be in charge of. Like, you know, RFK right. Jr. in charge of health. Yeah, you know, how is it that he's in, you know, a guy who is a crackpot spreading, you know, conspiracy theories and fake wellness things, that this guy would be put in charge of the nation's entire, you know, an anti-vaxxer, put in charge of the nation's entire health apparatus under HHS. Or Matt Gaetz, a guy who was, you know, literally involved in a child sex trafficking, a teenage girl sex trafficking ring, a guy who should be, who has been, as you put it, has been the subject of an investigation by the DOJ, being put in charge of the DOJ. And Pete Hegseth is a guy who's defended war criminals, and, you know, he's been put in charge now of the Department of Defense, and or supposedly going to be put in charge. So it's, you know, in each one of these cases, and I'm leaving others out.
No, we'll get to them. Don't worry.
I mean, you know, and there are a number of Trump selections or appointees that look to be, you know, you may disagree with them, but they have some qualifications. They are not wild-eyed crazy people. But for these very prominent ones, and some of the first ones he announced within a week of getting elected, it seemed like this was a deliberate negation. This was a deliberate statement that I'm going to break everything apart. And now with Matt Gaetz, we're not out of the woods yet with Matt Gaetz withdrawing. Because like you said, everything except for that last one, those were his qualifications for the office. One of the speculations people are making, and I think it's a correct one, is that, you know, this was a sacrificial nominee in a way, that he was there to be put out to be so outrageous and so bad and so horrible that he would get rejected. But then you could put somebody in and say, well, at least he's not Matt Gaetz. And, you know, you've set the bar, you know, so way, way, way down here that you can nominate somebody who's actually really terrible, but because he's not, you know, involved in paying sex for sex with a 17-year-old girl, then therefore he looks qualified by comparison. So I'm waiting for the next shoe to drop in terms of who goes to Justice Department in his place. But yeah, it seems like it's a deliberate power play on his part to basically say, I will, you talked about these anti-Trump types who, if you had told them years ago, that this would happen, they would have said, oh, it's totally exaggerated. This is a power play. This is how Trump, this is, you know, he doesn't have a theoretical or intellectual sense for this. He has this visceral sense for how you exert power over other people. And one of the things you make them do is you make them back you, and then you betray them and you stab in the back and you do worse and worse things to them. And then each point you still make them back you. And it's a way of basically making people humiliate themselves and abase themselves so that there will be no and you chip away at their resistance bit by bit. And something that people would have actually been outraged about and dug their heels in and opposed you, you know, 8 years ago, if you did this, now they'll say they'll meekly put out some whimpers of complaint, and they're going to go along. And I think that's what's really going on here. Is it, this is his way of saying, I can make you swallow anything because I've corrupted you stage by stage, and now's the point where I can just do whatever I want.
Damon, in light of Rob's insight about this, it's really interesting, isn't it, this dynamic, because one of the photos that was released in the last week was so revealing. It was Trump on the plane with Don Jr. And Elon and Robert Kennedy Jr. And what were they doing? They were all chowing down on McDonald's. And, you know, so Robert Kennedy, and we'll get to this, but Robert Kennedy is a complete crackpot, and he's wrong about lots of very, very important things, and not only wrong, but dangerously so. But one thing he's right about is that, you know, fast food is actually really bad for you, and he's opposed to it. And what does Trump choose to do? He makes him pose eating McDonald's. It's like, even as I'm elevating you, I'm reminding you that I can humiliate you.
Yes, absolutely. And that's been his MO all the way through his administration, the first one. And it's going to continue and get more intense as we go forward. I think Rob is completely correct that the dynamic we're seeing here is exactly Trump has tapped into, I think, sometimes justified, very often exaggerated, popular anger at our government institutions, failures that have gone adequately examined, owned up to programs of reform, not adequately pursued. And he's turned this into a kind of, I really do believe, nihilistic desire to simply tear them down. And the extent to which they, and by they, I mean, Trump and his vice president, Elon Musk. Oh, I mean, J.D. Vance. But it's kind of interesting how Elon is like his sidekick now and, you know, won't leave his side. And J.D. Vance is relegated to walking into Congress next to Matt Gaetz, who's now been the first sacrifice. So that's itself its own form of humiliation, I think, for Vance. But back to my main point, hard to stay focused in this environment. But what we're seeing is, you know, Elon Musk gave a speech at Mar-a-Lago last weekend. He said, this is going to be the most revolutionary government you have ever seen since the Revolutionary War itself. Last night, meaning Wednesday night this week, Bill O'Reilly gave an interview in which he said, you haven't seen a government this aggressive since the first term of FDR. He neglects, of course, to mention that FDR had over 300 Democrats in the House and 60 Democratic senators at the beginning, that went up to then 69 after the 1934 midterm election. That doesn't matter. We're still going to see this, which, of course, would mean if we did see that kind of activity and radical experimentation from a Trumpian point of view, would literally mean Trump governing as a dictator in defiance of Congress, which is far more narrowly divided. So, I mean, all of this, again, I could go on. We are seeing a group of people who have a kind of revolutionary fervor behind them. They want to take their 1.4% victory in the popular vote, roughly what it's going to end up being, and use this as a kind of Jacobin assault on the institutions of liberal democratic government. And, I am cheered to hear that Matt Gaetz has gone down. I hope there are many more defeats ahead in the 2 months we still have left until this show actually starts its run. But it is a remarkable spectacle to see it unfolding. And I am quite shaken by a lot of it, I have to admit.
Yeah, I think that applies to all of us. Bill Galston, so this is, you could say this is a sign of some life in the Republicans in the Senate. And as we just talked about at the tail end last week, but it's worth going into a little further now, one of the ways in which Trump is signaling that he does really want to dismantle our constitutional order is that he let it be known that he wanted the Senate to agree to these recess appointments where basically he would negate the entire advise and consent clause of the Constitution, where you would just say, no, you have to let me make recess appointments where, you know, they just get appointed without hearings, without votes. You know, if that were to happen, first of all, we don't know whether the Senate or the Republican senators who now have a majority or will in January have a majority in the Senate, whether they have any institutional, pride left to be able to say, no, that's not, you know, that's not the way this works. We are a co-equal branch and, you know, actually they're the superior branch and we don't agree this. The fact that Gates went down kind of suggests that all is not lost, doesn't it?
I hope it does. Mm-hmm. But the decisive moment may actually have come about 24 hours ago when John Cornyn reportedly told Matt Gaetz that it's all going to come out. And it is possible that Gaetz decided, much against his nature and very much against Donald Trump's nature, that discretion was the very better part of valor in this instance, because if it all did come out in a confirmation hearing, he would probably be destroyed. And he has higher political ambition, including potentially running for governor of Florida. So I'm not sure I take this as a leading indicator of senatorial spine, but I hope it is. And I hope it is for the reasons that I laid out in my column this week for the Wall Street Journal. And that is that, as the Journal editorial board said, and I don't often agree with them, always agree with them, what Trump is proposing to do with appointments is not unconstitutional, it's anti-constitutional. That is, it complies with the letter of the Constitution. And obviously, some very creative lawyering has gone on, you know, in the 4 years that Trump-friendly lawyers have had to think about this. But what it violates is the basic principle of the constitutional structure, as laid out by James Madison in deservedly famous Federalist Papers. And if the institutions that are charged with checking and balancing each other are not interested in defending their institutional prerogatives, the entire system of dikes and bulwarks against tyranny erodes badly. That's what's at stake. And this is really a moment of truth for the United States Senate, which much more than the House now has constitutional responsibilities that Donald Trump wants them to surrender. And we will see. I'm an agnostic on the question of whether they will stand up to him in the ways that are really essential. Machiavelli famously said in The Prince that it's better to be feared than to be loved. Mm-hmm. But Donald Trump has figured out how to have it both ways. He is loved by his friends and feared by his adversaries.
Oh, and he's feared by his friends too.
Well, that's fair enough. But he is loved by the people who voted him into office. You can't deny that.
You know, I wouldn't.
He didn't intimidate 75 million people into voting for him. So I stand by what I said. Obviously, the closer you get to Trump, the better advised you are to fear him. But I think he combines fear and love in a way that would have made Machiavelli green with envy. Stay tuned. We're not even through chapter one of a very, very long novel.
Linda, one of the tropes among Trump, not necessarily apologists, but people who wanted to sort of take him with a big grain of salt and say, you know, let's not get carried away with, you know, the dangers here. I mean, I would probably put Ross in this, Ross Douthat in this box, you know, who thinks that worries are overstated. Like when he was on our podcast, you know, we talked about some of the dangers of a second Trump term, and he was making the point, not for himself so much as for voters. He was saying, well, yes, but it's hard to make that case when he's already been president once and people have seen it. And we said, yes, but it's going to be different this time, you know, anyway. But one of the things is that they say, well, he's not really that dangerous. He's too much of a buffoon. Okay. And I mean, people thought Mussolini was a buffoon too, but when you look at the way Trump is behaving, like trying to take these critical agencies like the Department of Defense, which is, you know, in every society where you have an authoritarian, they have to have control of the military. And he's very well aware that the military stood up to him in his first term, that they had their own standards about what was appropriate and inappropriate to do. And he wants to make sure that doesn't happen again. So he's got Pete Hegseth nominated there. In the intelligence agencies pushed back on him, and the intelligence agencies are very powerful. And so he is putting this completely unqualified and national security risk, Tulsi Gabbard, in there. He attempted to put Gates in at Justice. I'm sure he'll find some other toady to replace Gates. But these are the critical places where if you do have authoritarian ambitions, mm-hmm. those are the ministries you need to control.
He's also putting in Matt Whitaker, who we may remember was acting attorney general in his first term and whom he wanted to elevate to the attorney general position in charge of, he's going to be the ambassador to NATO, another institution that he'd like to essentially undermine, destroy. You know, I am so troubled by this crew of people, and there are so many areas of attack. So many of them seem to have at least allegations of sexual assault. This is a plus for Donald Trump, who believes that he has been falsely accused of sexual assault. And so anybody who's been accused of sexual assault, he thinks, well, you know, I didn't do it, so you know, these guys didn't either. And of course, we know that at least one jury found that he did assault E. Jean Carroll. The other thing that's really surprising, and we haven't mentioned it, and TV has been so focused on the sex allegations, they're not focusing on the drug allegations. You know, these guys, Matt Gaetz was going to these parties that were drug fueled. Robert F. Kennedy, who may become our, you know, Secretary of Health and Human Services, was a heroin addict. He lost a brother to heroin addiction. Taking a look at him, because he likes to, you know, be there without his shirt on, he looks like he may be having some off-label use of steroids.
Yes, but fluoride will kill you,
but
Linda.
Fluoride will kill you, that's right. As somebody who has had to take steroids for very severe allergies, they are not to be fooled with. They are serious and dangerous drugs. So, you know, it's very disheartening to me. And, you know, to quote Matt, quote Steve Bannon, you know, Trump floods the zone with shit, as he put it so nicely. And that's exactly what he's done with these
nominations.
He's
flooding the government with it.
Yeah, he is. So that we can never sort of concentrate. It's one of the things that we've talked about on the show and I've mentioned before. It's very difficult to focus on any single scandal with Donald Trump because wait a few hours and a new and bigger scandal will emerge, and then you lose attention on the first one. And pretty soon, the audience tunes out. And I think that's what's happening here. But we are about to see some very unqualified people. Forget about, you know, their bad character, their drug use, their sex scandals. These people are unqualified for the jobs that they're going to be holding. And, you know, there are those who think, well, there are guardrails in the departments. You know, many of the positions that really run things are civil service, and they, you know, can't be removed. Well, no, they have a plan for that, too. They're going to try to remove middle managers. They're going to try to shrink government. Something I haven't always been opposed to. I shrunk the agency that I headed back in the Reagan years by about a third, I think, and was very proud of it. But this is going to be very haphazard, and I think it's going to be used politically more than it is to increase efficiency. I don't really believe that the American people elected Donald Trump to do what he is about to do. And it is a matter of time. We shall see whether there will be a backlash, but we are in for a roller coaster ride, and it's not going to be fun.
Well, the nights are getting cooler. Do you know that your temperature at night can have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality? If you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics to make temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long, no matter what the season. Did you know that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat? It can lead to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, eco-friendly bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent 99% of bacterial growth. They are self-cooling because of those NASA-infused thermoregulating fabrics that keep you at the perfect temperature all night long, so you get better sleep every night. They're also self-cleaning and prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth, leaving them fresher and cleaner 3 times longer than other sheets. They're luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands, and they feel as nice, if not nicer, than sheets used by some 5-star hotels. Go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save 40%. Use our promo code BEGTODIFFER at checkout, and you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that they back it with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/BEGTODIFFER and use that code BEGTODIFFER to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save another 40%. Again, that's trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to treat yourself. So, Robert Trzynski, Tulsi Gabbard, I want to go on to talk about Elon Musk, but we can't leave this topic, and we could have devoted the entire show to the lunacy of RFK Jr. I mean, it's not that, oh, he's wrong about vaccines, or I see in the press all the time, he's a vaccine skeptic. No. He doesn't know how to think about science at all. He believes in every crackpot conspiracy theory. He thinks his uncle and his dad were both killed by the CIA. He thinks that Bill Gates is trying to inject chips into us through the vaccine program. I mean, he is so far out there that it's like a cosmic bitter joke to put him in charge of anything health related. He is actually responsible for deaths by undermining faith in vaccines in Samoa. It's such a long, long list. But let me just say a word also about Tulsi Gabbard, because she is a national security risk. This is a person who went to visit Bashar Assad and then took his side, who repeats Kremlin talking points about American bio labs in Ukraine that justified Putin's invasion. She's a favorite on Russian television because she so often spouts Russian propaganda. What this will do to our intelligence agencies, if God forbid she is confirmed, is just inexplicable. People that, you know, are freaking out, and with very, very good reason. So I want to just put that on the table. You can comment on it if you want, but I want to get to this whole notion about Elon and Vivek Ramaswamy, because I think there's a tremendous amount of confusion out there. I mean, people keep talking about the new agency that the government that Trump is going to be creating. Well, there's not a new agency, and the only people who could create a new agency are the Congress, at least for now. We still do have a constitutional system where that's how government agencies are created. But the other thing is their notion that they're going to come in and create all of these savings is utterly preposterous. All they can do is make recommendations, right? I mean, anyway, your comments on them and our new oligarchs.
Well, I think that's the new oligarchs is the real issue here, which is that the fact is that Elon Musk has been sitting in on calls with Zelensky, sitting in. He made a visit to an ambassador. Was it ambassador from Iran? Yeah, he made a visit to the ambassador from Iran. And he's been conducting foreign policy on behalf of the United States on the grounds that what he's a buddy of the president. Yeah, that, you know, he's been hanging around
first
with the president.
Buddy.
Yeah, first buddy.
Yeah.
But the one that really caught my eye is that there was a conversation that Trump had with the CEO of Microsoft. Sort of, you know, an introduction, congratulations for winning the election. And Musk is sitting in on that one. Now, that's interesting because here it is. Here's a business rival. You know, here's someone who has competing business interests, especially with AI, to Elon Musk. And here Musk is sitting in on the call, reminding him, I'm the first buddy. I'm the favored oligarch who has the president's ear. And therefore, you have, you know, you're going to have to bow to me. You're going to have to defer to my business interests in any business relations we have. Because, you know, they were involved together in OpenAI and a lot of these things that are happening in Silicon Valley. They were both involved in that and they're rivals in that. So this is his way of saying, I have dominance over my rivals. It is a very oligarch thing to do. But that's why I think we need to understand this new so-called Department of Government Efficiency. Now, I love the Department of Government Efficiency, and it's redundant with an existing department of government that's in charge of the budget, and it has two heads, so it has a redundant head. So I call it the I'm calling it the Department of Redundancy Department. I mean, it is so comically not going to cut the budget. And of course, you know, we all know the numbers. We know the numbers. You know, you can't cut 27% or 30%. You can't cut that much out of the federal budget without doing, you know, cutting, without drastically cutting the military or drastically cutting entitlements, which, or defaulting on the service of the debt, all of which they've said, you know, we know they're not going to do. So this isn't about cutting the budget. This is about power. Everything, you have to be, maximum cynicism is required to understand the next Trump administration. Yes. Everything's about power. And what this is really about is Elon Musk going around to people and saying, well, look, you should cooperate with me. You should do what I want. You do me favors, whatever I need. Or I'll put you on the chopping block. I'll put your program, your thing, the thing that you want, that will go on the chopping block. So this isn't about how much he's going to cut. This is about him wielding that sword of Damocles over anyone that he wants to get a favor from or that he wants to threaten or he wants to cajole. And that's what this is really about. This is about, and the fact that he is not, you know, a head of a department and therefore not confirmed by the Senate has no official role whatsoever. Now, one of the things that I was talking about with regard to these appointments is I think people have the mistake of thinking when somebody wants to be a dictator, he wants to be an authoritarian, that he wants to build up government and make it big and strong. They actually like to have a weak, chaotic, unstructured government, because an unstructured government is one where there's nobody to get in my way. There's nobody to tell me no. That one in which the leader can basically assert his whims at all points. So having just guy who's just a friend of yours, who has no official position in the government, but who wields this tremendous power and is going and having meetings with ambassadors and telling everybody what they should do. That's exactly what an authoritarian wants. They want power that has no structure, no process, and therefore no checks and no controls.
You know, American politics now is starting to, you know, I think you're better off watching Game of Thrones or I, Claudius, to have a pull from back in the 1970s.
Well, I like to say PBS. That, I like to say this is what's happened when we trade out Lord of the Rings for Game of Thrones. You know,
exactly. But in light of that, you know, it does strike me, Rob, that one potential avenue this could go down is, you know, with this maximum corruption going on, at some point, Trump may start to look over his shoulder at Musk saying, wait a minute, he's using me to line his pockets. It should be going in my pocket. Get rid of this guy. So I can easily imagine that scenario. But then again, there are going to be other oligarchs who are going to be moving and maneuvering and with God only knows what consequences, since we will not have checks and, well, we may have checks and balances. We'll see. That depends. Okay, let's turn now to the Democrats because they are struggling to understand what happened and to plan for the future and so on. So, Bill Galston, I'll start with you. You've given this some thought. What do you think are the main things the Democrats have to do differently to be more appealing to voters going forward?
There are obviously some mistakes, serious mistakes that occurred during the current administration that will have to be repudiated and not repeated. I mean, I could go through my standard litany, but clearly, inflation was a killer. Immigration was a killer. You know, the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan was a killer. The decision of the president to cling to power well after his sell-by date had passed, the decision to make a vice presidential appointment, you know, on the basis of categories as opposed to qualifications. I could go on. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these things need to be put in the past. But I'm not an expert on many things, but I am an expert on reinventing the Democratic Party. And I can tell you exactly what's going to happen. Okay, there will be the circular firing squad will subside. Then serious meetings will be convened, analytical meetings, to try to specify exactly what were the most important short-term and long-term factors in the across-the-board decline of the Democratic Party. Different theories of the case will be developed, and then the party will fight out its future in a primary. And this will be one of the most open primaries in recent Democratic Party history. It will feature the widest possible range of alternatives to the status quo. The only thing I can guarantee is that someone who is seen as a representative of the current Democratic status quo will not be the nominee in 2028. Other than that, everything is open. But if you want my general theory of the case, is that this election was a great reckoning for the Democratic Party, you know, for sins of commission and omission over the past 25 years, you know, starting, you know, the effect of globalization on manufacturing jobs after China's accession to the WTO, the effect of long failed wars, you know, which had a profound effect, more on the Republican Party, interestingly, than the Democratic Party, That was one of the great reversals that Trump engineered. The financial crisis and the Great Recession, you know, which really totally undermined the credibility of traditional financial experts and economists, and led first to the Tea Party, and then I would suggest to the, you know, to preparing the ground for Trumpism.
Of course, that happened when a Republican was in office.
Well, yes, but that happened. And by the way, it totally discredited George W. Bush within the Republican Party.
Yeah.
But, you know, but also it discredited the Democrats who presided over the consequences of the financial collapse. And then, of course, you know, came the years when the party went crazy. Right. You know, culminating in.
You mean the wokeness?
Is that culminating in the dismal summer, you know, the Black Lives Matter summer of 2020, and all of the foolish, reckless slogans that circulated at that time, which many of which, you know, this year's losing Democratic candidate embraced and then had to try to walk away from, but couldn't. So the, you know, Biden's sins were just the cherry on the top of the whipped cream on top of a very large, soggy old cake. And the party is going to have to reckon with all of this. It's not going to be easy, as those of us who've been through the process once or more will attest. But that is what will happen, and it will happen because it must happen.
So, Damon, I'm going to turn to you and ask how much of that you agree with, and also reflect on 2004, an election that I remember. So 20 years ago, George W. Bush was resoundingly reelected. And afterwards, a lot of Democrats were doing what they're doing now, which is, you know, the circular firing squads and all that. And there was a lot of talk briefly. A lot of talk about how the Democratic Party really needed to readjust its positions on social issues like gay marriage, because it was perceived that that had hurt them in 2004. There were a number of ballot measures about it. And 4 years after that, Barack Obama won a sweeping victory. So I don't know. You know, people overread the results of any particular election and tend to overestimate, like, these causes, when a lot of the time it's really just about the economy and peace or prosperity, you know? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. That is the tendency. In fact, I got a big book advance in the wake of the 2004 election, because I purported to explain the great vote because of moral values that came out of that. But that, of course, was based on exit poll data that, when re-weighted later, sort of washed out and turned out to be not that big of a deal. So I know very personally consequences of overreading the results of an election. You know, I think I agree with pretty much everything Bill said. I think Bill and I are very much, as the representatives of the very moderate center left here on the podcast, we tend to agree, especially about the Democratic Party and its woes, and you know, at least in theory, what it would take for its prospects to improve. For me, at least, that very much tracks with people like Ryu Teixeira and other kind of old line center left types who have been critical of woke trends and the general moving of the party in the direction of representing the outlook and interests of highly educated urban professional types and their progressive and increasingly ever more progressive social and cultural commitments. those tendencies, that way of talking, tends to put them, I think, pretty far away from the outlook and way of thinking and talking of working class voters who used to be the base of the Democratic Party and increasingly are drifting to the Republicans, I think largely over cultural issues, but also over the severity, the intensity of Donald Trump's attack on sort of the political economy of the entire post-war era. We can really say critical things about like what that amounts to. Does that imply that we really need like the highest tariffs we've seen since the late 19th century as a response? I don't think so, but like that's what Trump wants to do. But the point is that you can win votes by taking a certain stance and sounding passionate about it in a way that I think energizes and activates a lot of anger among certain voters who don't think the Democratic Party is speaking to or for them anymore. As to other aspects of 2004, would it surprise me if the 2026 midterm elections look roughly analogous to the 2006, meaning a solid swing to the Democrats? Not at all. It's really close. Like what, with the Republican margin is going to be what, 3 seats, something like that. And then the Senate is a few seats. So I don't know. I don't know if the Senate holds much hope for the Democrats coming up soon, but certainly the House does. It would not take much of a rebound, which is the most normal thing in the world, is to have a vote in the first midterm election of a president against the party in power. And all it would take was, it would be an almost minuscule swing to actually give the chamber to the Democrats. So that would be, I think, the most reasonable thing to guess is going to happen. And then in 2028, really, who the hell knows? I mean, I'd like to think that America will wake up from this and say, oh my God, the price of eggs was high and this is what I got. But who really knows? I mean, polling on things like attachment to the core institutions of democracy don't often look that encouraging. Are there certain Americans who don't pay that much attention to the details, but would reward the Republican Party for, metaphorically getting the trains to run on time with some strong arm, strong man politics? Maybe. But I still think we have to keep in mind, and this will be my last point, is that I do think Trump's victory, the fact that he won the popular vote for the first time, is an earthquake and a big, big deal. I think the losses of the Democrats across lots and lots of demographic segments of its base are a serious problem, because once a voter votes Republican for the very first time, they might not come back. A lot of people did that in 1980, and then even more in 1984, and that was the end of that, and a new coalition had to be assembled by 1992. So that's a real threat, but it is also true that we are talking about like between the 47-yard lines of American politics here, and it would not take much for it to swing back the other way.
So, Linda, A.B. Stoddard had a nice piece in The Bulwark talking about how voters who were very involved and very informed about politics were supported Harris by something like 4, 5, or 6 points. And voters who paid practically no attention to politics supported Trump by about 19 points. And that the people who decided very late, typically the least informed, broke for Trump by large margins. And so the question then is, for people to, you know, somebody said earlier in this conversation, I don't think people voted for what they're going to get in a second Trump term. But in order for people to perceive that things have not gone well and to want to give an advantage to the other guy, the out party, things have to get pretty bad. And it has to be things like prices, inflation, the economy, or war and peace in order for the average person who doesn't pay very much attention to notice, right?
Well, yes, but let me play the part of every woman here. I'm not a scholar of the parties like Bill. I'm not, you know, a political scientist. So I'm just going to be every woman. And I think we are underestimating the role of personality and the individual candidate. I mean, you look back on the big name presidents of, you know, our adult lifetime, Ronald Reagan. You know, Hollywood, good looking, smart, could connect with voters. Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was a genuine moderate. When he ran, you know, thanks to Bill Galston and those at the Democratic Leadership Council and others, he ran on a platform that was about reforming welfare as we know it, et cetera. And if you look at his tenure, he didn't start any big, expensive programs. He did a lot of little programs that sort of, you know, satisfied people. And he did.
He took Bill Galston's advice.
He did, right. And he and you know, thanks to the Republican change in Congress, he was able to get welfare reform passed. And I think it was largely a success. You look at Barack Obama, he was larger than life. Again, another handsome, winning, charismatic candidate. I don't know what advice to give you, Bill, but you got to find somebody who is appealing in the way that our most successful recent presidents have been. They've got to connect with people. They cannot seem to be from an ivory tower, and all of the pieces underneath are going to be important. But, you know, I don't see the Democrats totally fixing the problem with, you know, the woke agenda. I think there are too many progressives in the party that won't let them do that. I don't think Democrats are ever going to be anything but big spenders. So I don't think that's going to be changed. But if the Democrats can come up with a really appealing figure. Now, some of us thought that Kamala Harris was appealing and that she reached out. The problem was that there were too many clips of her from 2019, 2020, in which she said weird things. I'm sorry, people did not, you know, support them. And, you know, Tim Walz was running around the country talking about the Republicans being weird. A lot of voters thought, well, the Democrats are pretty weird too.
Hey, so, can I interrupt to inject a statistic?
Yeah.
So this was from a New York Times Siena poll that was taken just before the election. 47% of likely voters said they viewed Harris as too liberal or progressive, whereas 49% said that Trump was neither too far right nor too far left.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, yeah. So, you know, I didn't have those statistics in my mind, but I do think that it's not just a matter of reforming the platform, of having the party try to rethink. I don't think the Democratic Party is ever going to become a party that I'm going to identify with. You know, I can see myself voting again for Democratic candidates, depending on who they are. And the average voter, as you talked about, as AB talked about, they don't spend the kind of time that we do reading the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times. They get impressions of people. And I think that, you know, Trump has a hold on the Republican Party. It's not clear to me that J.D. Vance will be able to step into that role. So at any rate, I think whoever leads the party is going to matter next time around. And Democrats had better hope they find the right person.
Well, this is a season for gratitude. And we all have things we are thankful for. And one of the things that we can improve upon, perhaps, is our mental health. We all have struggles, but they don't have to control us. That's why BetterHelp can be so useful. It's not just for people with serious trauma or major illness. We all need a sympathetic, dispassionate listener, someone with experience and perspective who can reassure us that others have the same insecurities, doubts, and fears and have overcome them. Therapy helps us to figure out how our own minds may be holding us back. If you're thinking of starting therapy, BetterHelp is a great option. It's incredibly convenient because it's entirely online, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and get started. And if that therapist isn't a good fit for any reason, you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. It's the gift you give yourself. So, make your brain your friend with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/begtodiffer today and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/begtodiffer. So, Rob, the another possible way this could go is that the Democrats are going to say, okay, populism is successful. We have our own populists in the mold of Bernie Sanders, and we didn't go far enough in that direction, and we need to embrace, you know, the economic message, get away from identity politics and you know, bear down on kind of lefty economic messages, you know, including eat the rich and all that. What do you think?
I'm going to go against some of the things people have said here that I don't think Please. Democrats should change very much. I think that it would be, okay. especially with a narrative, Trump didn't even actually get a majority of the vote. You know, he got more votes that than Kamala Harris by a very small margin, but now it's like 49.93% of the votes. We didn't even get a majority. Cause I, you know, first election night, it was like 51%. And I thought, oh my God, what did people do? And then I realized as it goes on that, no, this was an extremely narrow win. And it's a typical thing that people panic after that and say, oh, we have to totally overhaul the party and we have to completely change. And that's generally not whatever even ends up happening. But I think in this particular case, especially on issues like, you know, what I don't want Democrats to do is to try to become Trump light. Or a ripoff or a variation on Trump. Because for one thing, they're never going to compete with the original article. And it's going to end up being sort of a Me Too thing. Oh, I'm also against immigration. I'm also against globalization. I'm also for tariffs. And you become, you know, this is the whole thing we used to complain about on the right with the Me Too agenda of the Republican Party. I also think
in the original meaning of Me Too, not in the meaning of assaulting women.
Yeah, not well. There's the Me Too in terms of assaulting women is very relevant today, right now. I'm wondering, you know, what the hell happened that happened in 2017, 2018.
But you're talking about an earlier phenomenon.
This is the earlier version of saying, you know, we're for the welfare state too, and always being sort of following behind the Democrats on their agenda. Right. And I think that the Democrats shouldn't do the same thing to the Republicans now. But the big thing is this. I think this is a test of do we actually believe what we believe? That is, do we believe that massive new tariffs are going to raise prices and make things more expensive or bring prices down and make everybody more prosperous? Or do we believe that, you know, deporting 5 to 10 million people out of the American labor force, that's the amount of number of people who are illegal immigrants who are working. They're actually planning to deport more people than that, including legal immigrants. So, you know, getting 10 million people out of the 10 to 20 million people out of the labor force, is that going to make America more prosperous and growing faster, or is that going to lead to a crisis? I think it's going to shut down multiple industries. You know, do all the policies that Trump and, you know, causing chaos at the Justice Department, undermining our foreign policy, letting Russia run wild in foreign policy, is all of that actually going to make America great again? Or is it going to lead in 1 year or 2 years or 4 years to disaster? No, I think it's a, you know, if it makes America great again, I'm going to have to fundamentally change my own political ideology because I will have been wrong this entire, for my entire life. But it also would go against a lot of what I know from history as the example. I mean, you know, the Smoot-Hawley bill did not bring America peace and prosperity. It helped trigger the Great Depression, right? So we have a lot of history to think that this is going to end in disaster, that 2 years from now or 4 years from now, people are going to look back and say, why did I vote for that schmuck when now, I, you know, eggs are $10 a dozen. Why did I vote for this guy when we're suddenly in a whole bunch more wars? Why did I vote for this guy when, you know, it's even harder to afford a home because we kicked out all the guys who were doing the drywall and the tile jobs. So, you know, when we ground we made it much more expensive and much more difficult to build a house. So I think you know, if we really believe, if my ideology is right, if my view of the world is right, this will not result in making America great again. It will result in disaster, and we're going to see the pendulum swing back and possibly swing back very hard.
Okay. I hope that that is true, but I would say it is also possible that Trump won't deport very many people at all. He'll do some big, you know, sort of photogenic deportations of a few criminals, and then he'll say it's done because he'll realize it's just way too expensive
and difficult.
That's
what he did with the wall. That's what
and it's what he did with the wall, exactly. And he'll say it's done, and his people will be thrilled, and you know.
Well, that's my projection for the most annoying way this ends, which is we actually stop Trump from doing all the worst things he tried to do. And we actually succeed in preventing a lot of his agenda. And then people turn around and say, well, look, you guys were making all these horrible warnings about how terrible he was. And it all turned out fine. And it turned out fine because we stayed up nights, you know, not getting sleep, trying to figure out how to stop everything. But, you know, if we succeed, it will be the most annoying possible outcome.
Although I don't think we could possibly prevent him from doing all the awful things he plans. So don't worry. He's going to do lots of them. Yeah, Bill, I'm coming to you. You wanted to differ.
Yeah, I sure do.
Okay.
You know, Rob, I recognize your arguments because they were exactly the same arguments that were made against Bill Clinton in 1992. That, you know, he's moving, you know, he's moving away from Democratic commitments. He's, you know, that, you know, Democrats are becoming Republicans light. And it was, you know, it that was a misjudgment then, and it's a misjudgment now.
Well, so I would respond to that by saying that Bill Clinton actually stole the right things from Republicans.
Well,
he stole free trade, and he stole welfare reform.
Okay, but, you know, I'm not interested in just having the pendulum swing back. I'm interested in getting us, the country, out of this 50-50 rut and actually having a sustainable governing majority. So I agree with you that Trump is going to have a very hard time fulfilling his promises. And the closer he gets to fulfilling his promises, the worse it's going to be for the country. So let's stipulate to that, as the lawyers would say. But why not adopt a belt and suspenders strategy and try to strengthen the potential Democratic majority at the same time? And if you do that, then the party is going to have to go through a hard process of dumping overboard the ballast that threatened to sink the ship. Why should we choose between those two strategies? Right? We ought to, you know, among other things, the only thing that the Democratic Party can control is what it becomes. It cannot control what Donald Trump chooses to do or not to do. So I fundamentally disagree with you.
Okay, Bill, what about Linda's point that she doubts the party can really move that far out away from the progressives because
you
they're too powerful?
I recognize that argument too.
Okay.
Because back in 1990 and 1991, we were told, you know, welfare, as we now know it, is a great shibboleth in the Democratic Party, right? You can't do that. All the minority groups will rise up. You know, we were told that fiscal responsibility and a balanced budget, that wasn't our program. That was the Republicans' program, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are the oldest arguments in the book. Now, maybe the party has changed so fundamentally that we can't do again what we did then. But I'm going to tell you this. I'm going to die trying.
Okay.
And I'll be there with you, Bill.
let's move now to the final segment, highlight or lowlight of the week. There were a lot of lowlights this week. So, I mean, I guess Matt Gaetz withdrawing could be a highlight. But all right, let's start with Damon Linker.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, there are so many things. Like, should I talk about Russ Vaught, the probable nominee for OMB, who is going on Tucker Carlson's show to explain how the president can spend money without Congress authorizing it? But no, I actually want to make, I mean, that's a runner-up. And if it's that steps on anyone's toes, I'm sorry, then it's almost like I've picked two. But my real one for the week, and it's a good one for me to to choose because I am a critic of what I see of the excesses of a lot of trans activists, like several of the people on the show. I'm skeptical of claims about, allowing minors to begin undergoing medical interventions for gender transition and so forth. But I have to say that the behavior of Representative Nancy Mace in the House this week against the new representative from Delaware, Sarah McBride, who is a trans woman, was absolutely despicable. It is nothing other than her trying to prove there is one form of rank bigotry that I not only can get away with, but I will be rewarded for in the halls of Congress. And I'm going to do it and I'm going to keep doing it. And it has been Sarah McBride who has behaved like the very best of American public servants in saying, I don't care about bathrooms. I don't care about anything. I am here to serve the people of Delaware. Let me get to work. And yet Nancy Mace will not stop with her rank bigotry. And I say, you have been the 75th thing that a Republican has done or said in the last 2 weeks to convince me of this, but you have done it maybe more tersely and effectively than any of them in showing me that your party needs to go. I, as you can tell, I'm pretty livid about this.
No, really 100%. Thank you for that, Damon. Yeah, just the cruelty is the point. Mm-hmm. And it is beyond horrifying that there's a whole wing. I'm not going to say a whole political party because I don't really think that's the case. But there is a whole wing of a political party for whom this is catnip. They love this. They thrill to it. And they are despicable. One might even say deplorable. Rob Trzynski.
I was going to choose as both the highlight and the lowlight is the same thing, which is that photo you mentioned of RFK Jr. sitting there eating his greasy McDonald's hamburger and with the giant 20-ounce Coke next to him, chock full of high fructose corn syrup, all the stuff this guy professes to hate. And the part about it that's subtle that you have to think about a little bit is they're sitting on a plane, right? They did not just get this from McDonald's. They didn't just come through the drive-thru. This is cold McDonald's. This is McDonald's been sitting around for at least a half an hour. So it's like the very worst, most humiliating thing to have to go through. But then the other subtle thing about it is, who's not there? J.D. Vance is not there. Trump, since the election, has been swanning around with his billionaire pals and his he likes people who are already famous, who are already pop culture celebrities. And J.D. Vance is so clearly not the cool kid. And he doesn't want to have anything to do with them. He's disappeared. You've barely seen him at all for a week. So it's sort of the highlight, the low light in the sense of, look at this humiliation he's visiting on these people around him. And this is the behavior of a narcissist who feeds on the humiliation of other people. Talking about this thing about the transgender bathrooms in Congress, Nancy Mace, this is a sort of politics now run by the high school bullies, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, that's also the highlight because, as you said, Mona, we have to find the humor in these things. And seeing some of the very worst people be humiliated by the very guy that they glommed onto and sucked up to kind of has a certain Schadenfreude and a certain, I mean, no political satirist could have written this. This is like way beyond anything that somebody like Tom Wolfe. I mean, I think Tom Wolfe is the person I think of when I think of this. He could not have dreamed this up. So this is satire beyond what somebody could have invented.
Yes. Linda Chavez.
Well, you want to know where J.D. Vance was? He was in the halls of Congress escorting Matt Gaetz around to Senator's office. That went really well, obviously. Yes. So, and there's one thing that Trump doesn't like, and that's a loser. And clearly his first assignment, J.D. Vance failed. So I don't think we're going to be hearing a lot from J.D. Vance. Well, I have a somewhat different highlight, and it's really sparked in part by the conversation we've been having in the latter part of the show. And that is, you know, what's happening on the left in terms of the woke phenomena. One of the things that has struck me over the last 6 months or so is that as anti-woke as I have been for my entire political life, it wasn't always called woke, but it was called other things. I am less agitated by the woke left than many of my friends are. And so I'm trying to figure that out. I'm trying to figure out what is it about the woke phenomenon that scares people so. And I read a piece today on the Free Press. It was a conversation with Natan Sharansky, the famous dissident who now lives in Israel, a Russian dissident who spent years in the gulag. And he talks about the struggle between liberalism and progressivism. And it was interesting, I thought, because he was encouraging people like myself who thought of themselves in the past as neoconservatives to embrace the term liberalism, that we are liberals. And the big difference he sees between the two phenomena is that liberals recognize that society is not perfect, that government is not perfect, and they are looking for ways to reform it, whereas progressives want to tear it down and replace it entirely. And he makes reference to that as neo-communism. I'm not sure I 100% agree with him, but it's a good piece, and I recommend it to our listeners.
Thank you. Bill Galston.
By the way, you know, Sharansky is absolutely correct in making that distinction. A lot of other people have been doing it. An entire movement is forming around liberalism, not in the left-right sense, but in the more philosophical sense of the founding principles as the only basis of national unity that exists, given our ideological and demographic diversity. But I digress. My lowlight, and it deserves more visibility than it's gotten up to now, is a bill that may very well pass the House of Representatives that will give the Secretary of the Treasury expanded authority to remove the 501c3 designation from any group that the Treasury Secretary deems to be aiding and abetting or even encouraging terrorism. Oh, now, the problem with this bill, you know, the problem with this bill, you know, is that it removes all of the existing procedural protections for 501c3 groups who are advocating views that are very unpopular to the incoming administration, but by no stretch of the imagination amount to support for terrorism. This is very dangerous because if you make a list of the fundamental pillars of liberal democracy, not in the left-right sense, but in the philosophical sense, a vigorous and diverse civil society unbossed by and unhindered by the government is an extraordinarily important one. We must do everything we can to shine a spotlight on this very dangerous development, which could very well become law next year, although not this year, and stop it before it gives the new administration a tool to rein in civil society the way autocrats like Viktor Orban have been able to do in their countries. Let's give this some visibility.
Thank you for that. And it dovetails with my lowlight, which is that this week in Hong Kong, 45 pro-democracy heroes, people who were political actors, journalists, teachers, lawyers, were just sentenced to long sentences for crimes that for so-called crimes. Some of them were for things like criticizing the government, which under the expansive law that was passed a couple of years ago in Hong Kong, forced through, of course, by Beijing, includes all kinds of things under this rubric of encouraging terrorism or encouraging subversion. And so it becomes a national security offense to do things like run in a primary, which is what some of these people are now going to jail for a very long time for doing. Look, ever since 1997, when Great Britain handed Hong Kong back to China. We knew this was coming, but, you know, it is worth recalling that the Chinese government, the Chinese government in Beijing, made all kinds of promises and representations that there would be one country, two systems, that the rights and liberties that the Hong Kong residents had come to enjoy under British rule would be maintained unhindered. And slowly the noose has tightened to the point now where some of you may remember the umbrella movement and other really incredibly inspiring movements of people in Hong Kong for their freedoms. They're being crushed, a boot on humanity's neck, as Orwell put it. So it's a very, very sad day, but it's also a reminder of what's at stake when autocratic governments take control. So let it be a warning. With that, I want to thank our guest, Rob Trzezinski, and of course, our regulars. Our producer is Jim Swift. Beg to Differ will not be back next week in observance of Thanksgiving, but we want to wish all of our viewers and listeners a very happy Thanksgiving. There are still things to be thankful for in this world, lots of them, and we'll be back the week after.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.